But I'm also, we also have to acknowledge that the nations in the region said that we don't have, want to have anything to do at any meeting unless the Cubans are there at the meetings.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Danny Glover, Medea Benjamin, that does it for our show. Again, today, an historic day in Washington, D.C. We are right here in front of the Cuban embassy. Today, the Cuban flag will go up for the first time in 54 years. Special thanks to Amy Littlefield, Sam Alcock, Dennis Moynihan, Julie Crosby. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felter, Min Shake, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org to see all of our coverage of Cuba over the years. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the MLK Dream Run, the weekend of August 1st and August 2nd. The 5, 10, and 15K runs will take you through the charming and historic retail, residential, and parkscapes of the Seoul District. The run and weekend events include music, food, and entertainment after the run and exist to honor Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, delivered in Washington, D.C., August 1963, during the March for Jobs and Equality. Again, that's the MLK Dream Run, the weekend of August 1st and 2nd at the corner of Northeast Martin Luther King in Alberta in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Every Monday night at 8 o'clock, you can hear this voice alerting you that
you are about to cross the border.
And then follow the footsteps to a two-hour-long sustained environment of uninterrupted sonic art or new electronic, experimental, or postmodern music. Audio that breaks and rewrites the rules to create entirely new worlds of sound. Where will you be on Mondays at 8 when the door slams shut? Here on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair Saturday, July 25th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. with an after-party on Clinton Street from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. The community parade, Metamorphosis, will start at 10:45 a.m. There will also be artisan, craft, and community booths, sidewalk sales, live music, food, and more. Again, that's the 23rd Annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street going until 9 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, climate activists around the country protest Shell's plans to drill for oil in the Arctic Ocean.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker signs an anti-abortion bill into law.
And the person responsible for hanging sex toys from Portland power lines spoke with Vice Media.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 20th, 2015. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. 19-year-old Felipe Bitar is being hailed as a local hero after rescuing a woman trapped in a burning car at a Beaverton gas station on Saturday. Bitar was walking by the station with his brother when they saw the plume of smoke and fire. A crowd of people stood around, taking video of the incident, but no one attempted to help the woman until Bitar arrived. He quickly punched in the driver's side window and pulled the woman from the burning car. Bitar received minor cuts from breaking out the car window. The woman suffered non-life-threatening injuries from smoke inhalation. The cause of the fire is still being investigated.
The inmate found dead at the Multnomah County Detention Center on Friday has been identified as 29-year-old Lloyd Milton Vernig of Sandy, Oregon. The Multnomah County Medical Examiner conducted an autopsy on Saturday and found no evidence of trauma. The examiner is still working to identify the cause of death. Vernig was booked into jail last Thursday on accusations of heroin possession, burglary, unauthorized use of a motor vehicle, and fraudulent use of a credit card. The following night, he was found dead during a routine check. In 2012, Vernick was convicted of delivery of heroin within 1,000 feet of a school.
The first container ship to call on the Port of Portland's Terminal 6 since April will drop anchor on Tuesday. Washington-based Westwood Shipping Lines represents the smallest container service to visit the Port of Portland. The port lost 99% of its shipping traffic in the wake of an extended labor disagreement that affected 29 ports along the West Coast. Elements of the Port of Portland dispute involve the IBEW, the Longshoremen, the port, and the shipping company ICTSI Oregon Incorporated. The Department of Labor issued rulings against the unions after complaints by the port of work slowdowns by dock workers. In mid-February, Korean shipper Hanjin notified the port that because of the labor unrest, they would no longer call on the port. Hanjin represented approximately 80% of the shipping traffic. Shortly thereafter, Germany-based Hapag-Lloyd announced they would also cease shipping operations at the port. Hapag-Lloyd represented the remaining 19% of sea traffic. The Puyallup-based shipper will call on the Port of Portland each month until December 2015.
So-called kayaktivists gathered around the country on Saturday to protest Shell's drilling in the Arctic. Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company's drilling fleet is currently making its way from the Port of Seattle to northern Alaska. Activists joined Seattle protesters in solidarity in Boston, Detroit, San Francisco, Minnesota, Florida, and elsewhere. In Washington, D.C., activists gathered in Lafayette Park outside of the White House to ask the president to suspend Shell's permit. Kayaktivists in Seattle originally used direct action to try and stop Shell's drilling fleet from leaving the port. But the fleet eventually left, and now activists are worried drilling could start as early as next week. In Portland, protesters gathered in solidarity at the Columbia Annex. They're also protesting the arrival of Shell's icebreaking vessel, which gashed its hull earlier this month. The MSV Phoenicia will arrive in the Port of Portland for repairs. Following the lead of kayaktivists in Seattle, Portland protesters say they are playing nonviolent acts of civil disobedience on both land and sea to stop the vessel from leaving port. Senator Jeff Merkley spoke briefly at the rally. Last week, the senator introduced a bill that would prevent the government from renewing and issuing new leases for gas and oil in the Arctic. We'll have an audio from the Portland protest after our news broadcast during our in-depth investigation.
83 Portland Parks and Recreation employees categorized as casuals can expect benefits, vacation time, and health care. These workers now fall under the present union contract because of Local 483, the union that represents Portland Parks employees, which filed a grievance and won. The union benefits will go into effect retroactively as of July 1st. KBOO's Kristen Yount spoke with Erica Askin about the decision.
This is Kristen Yount. I'm speaking with Erica Askin. She's the business manager at Leuna Local 483. The city just agreed to unionize 80 positions within the city Parks and Rec. Is that right?
Well, the city actually agreed to comply with an arbitration ruling that said that they must cease and desist from assigning union work to so-called casual employees.
So there were other positions within the city Parks and Rec that were covered by the union or included in the union, and these other positions weren't, even though it was the same work. Is that right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
So when was the grievance filed?
In 2013, while we were bargaining, but for over a decade, the Bureau of Portland Parks and Recreation has been using these so-called casual staff to do the duties covered under the city's bargaining agreement. And most of them are not casual at all. A lot of them are dedicated employees who have worked there year after year, sometimes a year, sometimes five, sometimes 10. I even know of somebody who's worked with Parks and Rec for 24 years and has been misclassified as a casual employee, even though she's coordinating whole preschool programs. So we didn't believe that these staff were casual, and to challenge this practice, we filed a grievance. The arbitrator heard the grievance not until the beginning of 2015, and then on May 1st, we received the arbitrator's ruling, and he said that the city must stop assigning union work to seasonal employees. And our position was that seasonal employees doing union work should be protected under our contract with the city. The actual workers who are going to be brought into the union can expect wages that are commensurate with our contract and with the other workers doing the same jobs, and health care for the first time, and some job protections as well, and benefits like vacation and sick leave. And in terms of changes in the community centers, you know, these so-called casual employees who have been misclassified have been serving families for decades, and they've built strong relationships with their community member patrons who are going to the centers. And when these positions become full-time, I think that the community can expect those relationships to be preserved and to continue to grow. In terms of putting the city on track to become a leader in providing fair wages and benefits to the staff, that's going to be a big change for our community. It sets an example for the private sector, and it's going to help workers throughout the metro area.
Are the positions that are now covered by the union protected? Can the city reduce the amount of employees that they have? Are these formerly casual, so-called casual employees, protected in any way? Are their positions protected?
In terms of the budget for the next year, the money has been included in the agreement to fund these positions. The 83 positions that are being funded for the next fiscal year, the city is not going to be reducing those positions.
The Parks and Rec system for the city is a moneymaker for the city, isn't it? Don't they bring in a lot of revenues through class fees and swim classes and things like that?
Yeah, the community centers definitely do bring in revenue. The community is relying on the services that they're providing in the center. So there is some revenue that's brought in through these centers, definitely.
Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to say with respect to this decision?
Well, this is really just a partial agreement for compliance. It's the first step towards complying with the arbitrator's ruling that they have to cease and desist from assigning the union work, workers who aren't classified correctly. So we expect to reach a comprehensive agreement with the city for everyone who hasn't been included in phase one. So there's still more to come. And we're looking forward to working closely with Commissioner Fritz and the Parks and Rec Bureau to solve the whole issue by then.
Thank you so much for talking with us today. This is Erica Askin. She is the business manager for Liuna Local 483. Just came to an agreement, a preliminary agreement with the city to have 83 formerly classified casuals added to their local. For KBOO News, this is Kristen Yount.
Portland Streetcar will raise single-ride fares on September 1st. But according to Portland Streetcar Executive Director Dan Bauer, the company is trying to pay attention to how those hikes will affect the homeless. Portland Streetcar, which began service in 2001, is owned by the City of Portland and serves the downtown Portland area. It operates between the South Waterfront and Nob Hill to the Lloyd District and OMSI. According to the Portland Streetcar's website, day use, monthly and annual streetcar fares will increase in September. The Portland Business Journal reports that the streetcar only fare will increase from $1 to $2, while monthly passes will jump from $23 to $40 and annual passes will rise from $250 to $400. Mr. Bauer told KBOO that Portland Streetcar is working with TriMet by providing a streetcar-only honored citizen ticket, which can be given to homeless riders or those over 65. That fare will only increase 25 cents from $1 to $1.25. With the new fares, Portland Streetcar says it will improve Saturday service with streetcars every 15 minutes and add late-night service for the A and B loops for better coverage of the Rose Quarter, among other changes. Bauer told the Portland Business Journal that Portland Streetcar has the lowest fares among modern streetcar systems in the United States.
Last week, hundreds of sex toys were found hanging from power lines in Portland. On Thursday, the person responsible for the prank contacted the website vice.com to provide more information on what she's doing and why. The perperpetrator is an artist in her 20s, a recent college graduate and retail worker. She has to remain anonymous, partly to avoid the police and partly to keep her name from being forever linked to sex toys on the internet. The woman plans to continue tying together the rubber toys and tossing them around town. As for her reason, she said that, quote, "It's an exercise in happiness. It was just a fun, hilarious thing to do." Crews for the utility companies in the city are not amused. They've been removing the objects in Portland for the last 2 weeks. The power companies say at worst, there are potential safety and reliability issues. And, they add, at best, it creates a situation where crews have to spend time and money removing the toys. A Pacific Power spokesman said, it isn't just a local issue. He said a crew removed an adult toy from a power line in southern Oregon about a month ago.
A fire near the Lewis River Hatchery, northeast of Woodland, Washington, is now consuming 80 acres as of this morning. The fire started in industrial timberland just before noon yesterday and grew from 7 acres to more than 40 acres by 6 p.m. According to the Washington Department of Natural Resources, 3 helicopters and 3 air tankers were called out to assist the firefighting efforts.
It's 5:16. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
If you think that none of today's presidential candidates care about people like you, check out Republican Scott Walker. The Wisconsin governor not only cares, he wants to sit down with you, get your ideas, and stay in close touch. No matter who you are, Scotty wants you to join his team so his presidency can be your presidency. Not a Republican? No problemo, amigo. Walker doesn't check your papers. Well, except for that $1 million check you have to write to his super PAC. That's the ticket price for entering Walker's inner circle, where you can discuss your policy concerns and seek personal favors straight from your lips to the candidate's ear. Even if you're a common working stiff, just give $1 million and you're in. Is this a great country or what? Maybe you're wondering what specifically your money buys. Well, Scott's Super PAC even prints out a handy purchasing slip showing that you'll be, quote, an executive board member of the Walkerites campaign. Thus, you'll have 2 private dinners with the man, a Walker staffer dedicated to your needs, special briefings and weekly emails, bi-monthly conference calls, bi-annual retreats, and best of all, quote, an exclusive executive board pin. Golly, I haven't been this excited or felt so included since the 1950s when I became a member of the Mickey Mouse Club and got my own set of mouse ears. This is Jim Hightower saying, when the Supreme Court descended into the Alice in Wonderland fantasy that corporations are people and money is speech, it was inevitable that American politics would devolve to a frivolous game that shuts out the workaday majority and enthrones a Koch brothers plutocracy sustained by secret money super PACs and whorish candidates like Walker. To help end this corrupt mockery of our electoral democracy, go to democracyisforpeople.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for audio from the Shell Arctic drilling protest in Portland. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, U.S. Congressman Earl Blumenauer and ACLU's Executive Director David Rogers speak in downtown Portland about why marijuana legalization matters on Prison Pipeline. At 7, it's River Signal. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with a 10% chance of rain, high of 79 and a low of 56. Today in history, in 1969, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin became the first men to walk on the moon. It is also Colombian Independence Day. In 1810, Colombia established its first government independent of the Spanish monarchy. The quote of the day is from Mahatma Gandhi. Earth provides enough for every man's needs, but not every man's greeds.
Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker signed a bill into law today that bans abortion in the state after 20 weeks of pregnancy. The law makes no exceptions for severe fetal anomalies or for pregnancies resulting from rape or incest, but does allow exceptions for medical emergencies. Walker, a 2016 presidential candidate, said he supports the legislation because fetuses can feel pain at 20 weeks, an assertion that has been disputed by the mainstream medical community. Wisconsin joins a dozen other states with similar bans on abortion. In May, the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals ruled Idaho's ban on abortions after 20 weeks was unconstitutional. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell vowed to bring a federal version of the 20-week abortion ban to a vote this year, and nearly every GOP presidential candidate has endorsed it. Several major medical groups in Wisconsin oppose the 20-week abortion ban, including the Wisconsin chapter of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the Wisconsin Medical Society, the Wisconsin Academy of Family Physicians, and the Wisconsin chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. A group of 100 gynecologists in the state wrote a letter to Walker and members of the state legislature earlier this month, urging them to oppose the bill because they say it, quote, ties the hands of doctors seeking to help women.
About 50 members of the Ku Klux Klan gathered at the South Carolina courthouse in Columbia on Saturday. They were protesting the removal of the Confederate flag from the state house last week. However, a counter rally overcame the KKK's numbers earlier in the day. The counter rally included members of the Black Lawyers for Justice and Black Educators for Justice, a Florida organization with links to the new Black Panther Party. At the peak of both rallies, about 2,000 people were gathered outside the courthouse in the sweltering southern heat. There was a large police presence at the rally as well, with most officers wearing bulletproof vests and helmets. In the end, 5 people were arrested and at least one physical altercation occurred.
A Wyoming detoxification center was the object of gunfire on Saturday. Riverton, Wyoming resident Roy Clyde told police that, quote, homeless people were using city parks as a sewer, unquote. Clyde told police he was angry, and that's what made him shoot at the detox center. Clyde, a Riverton Park employee of 13 years, fired several shots into the Center of Hope facility. Riverton Police Captain Eric Murphy said responding officers arrested Clyde outside the center and jailed him on a charge of first-degree murder. Murphy declined to identify either the man killed in the shooting or the man who was injured. Murphy told the Associated Press, quote, I don't think it's any secret that we have an intoxication problem and a homeless problem. It's been brought up in several open public meetings. Murphy said Clyde entered the facility through an unlocked rear door. He then passed 2 staff members on the way to the client area. There, he shot both men. He then returned outside, laid the pistol on the ground, and was arrested by Riverton police.
When you're getting ready to go to work in the morning, you may be unaware of the toxic chemicals you are applying to your body in the form of deodorant, shaving products, shampoos, toothpaste, conditioners, body wash, sunblocks, and more. In fact, while most people assume that all chemicals, especially those used by and on humans, are tested and regulated by government agencies, nothing is farther from the truth. Bottom line, only about 1% of nearly 84,000 chemicals have been tested. The average man is exposed to approximately 85 chemicals daily, some harmless, but some are carcinogens, neurotoxins, and endocrine disruptors. The average woman is exposed to 168 chemicals, and if she is pregnant, she passes these chemicals to her unborn child. In fact, 300 chemicals have been detected in the umbilical cord blood of newborns. Federal rules designed to ensure product safety haven't been updated in more than 75 years. New untested chemicals appear on store shelves all the time. In 2013, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists issued a report that found robust evidence linking toxic environmental agents, which include consumer products, to adverse reproductive and developmental health outcomes. Recently, Senators Dianne Feinstein and Susan Collins were introduced Senate Bill 1014, the Personal Care Product Safety Act, a bill that would strengthen the FDA's authority to regulate dangerous ingredients in personal care products such as cosmetics. Senator Feinstein pointed out that Europe has a strong protection system, which includes product registration and ingredient reviews. This proposed legislation has support from companies and consumer groups alike, but is not expected to pass. In addition, two Senate bills have been introduced to allegedly address chemical additives. None of the bills are expected to pass. If you're interested in checking up on the chemicals in your personal care products, go to the website of the Environmental Working Group at www.ewg.org/skindeep/.
A coalition of advocacy groups issued a report earlier this week about the influence the United States Chamber of Commerce is exerting to benefit the tobacco industry in developing countries. Public Citizens Director of Congress Watch spoke with KABU reporter Robin Ryan about the impact the Chamber's efforts are having on these countries as they attempt to develop regulatory policy on tobacco products.
I'm talking with Lisa Gilbert. She is the director at Public Citizens Congress Watch. And we're going to talk about a report that your organization put out regarding the United States Chamber of Commerce and the influence that they're exerting internationally on behalf of the tobacco industry. It's been nearly 2 years since the U.S. Chamber became the first organization to spend $1 billion on political process at the federal level. What impact did that have on the level of awareness with regard to producing this current report?
Well, certainly something that we're concerned about is their endless proliferation of influence. I think, the 2 years since that spending has happened, the Chamber has only grown in power. This report primarily focuses on the influence they have internationally, but, their influence internationally is engendered by the clout they have with the government here at home. So certainly it's had major repercussions.
When you look at the long-standing history of behavior from the tobacco industry and from the Chamber of Commerce, is there any room left for surprises?
I mean, in terms of their perspectives, I would say not. They are clearly advocating for the biggest corporations that are their members. The problem with that is they claim, purport to represent thousands of the smallest businesses in the U.S. Clearly, there's very different interests at play when you're talking about a mom-and-pop grocery store and you're thinking about the needs of Exxon. And I think this big tobacco case is a clear example of that, where certainly public health and what regular Americans and small businesses want is falling by the wayside in the pursuit of a big corporate interest.
In what ways has the chamber used its influence to delay and or diminish regulation of these products?
Although we have not a lot of clarity around their domestic work because of the lack of disclosure around their political spending and their lobbying, internationally we know a little bit more because they work through AmChams, their American Chamber of Commerce's affiliates that are located in international regions. And in our report, we take a look at how those entities are playing in politics and trying to influence government regulation on tobacco issues. And what we found is that in a number of developing countries, the AmChams delivered threatening letters trying to cast doubt on the science behind tobacco control. They tried to exaggerate the economic impacts or repercussions in moving forward with strong tobacco regulations, crying wolf about what it would mean for trade issues. So certainly, by pursuing all of this, they're kind of exporting well-documented tobacco industry tactics and using them internationally to try to get what they want.
How often do these tactics work?
We didn't look sort of statistically at that. It's hard to do so and know why governments are making the decisions they're making. But I will say that one of the reasons that the chamber is as successful as it is, and not just on tobacco issues, is that for many developing countries, it's perceived as the government, the American business community coming in to speak, is the U.S. chamber coming in to speak. And so certainly if you're a developing nation and you're faced with some sort of edict from America, you might do what you're told. So that's part of the problem. The chamber claims to be representing the U.S. and the U.S. business community. And as we know, they truly just represent the biggest corporations over here, not the public interest over here.
Your report does 5 case studies in the pressure that was applied by the chamber. In those 5 cases, how many of those countries gave in to the pressure and how many went ahead and did what they were going to do and face no consequences subsequently?
We profiled places where we thought that the chamber did have influence. So I think of the 5, 4 of them did not move forward with the regulations exactly the way they had been planning to before the chamber weighed in. In addition to the 5 case studies, we also looked at a slew of other places where the chamber has been interfering in tobacco control. And there's a table that looks at that in more detail in the report.
The names I saw most were BAT and PMI. Can you tell me what relationship PMI has with the Altria group?
Sure. Well, so PMI is Philip Morris, and I think most would know that they're one of the biggest manufacturers of tobacco. And then the Altria group is a tobacco giant, and it's the former parent company of Philip Morris. So one of the conflicts that we highlighted when we were trying to get to the bottom of the connections between the chamber and tobacco is the fact that a top executive at Altria actually currently serves on the chamber's board.
Can you go over the recommendations the report makes to curtail the efforts that defy an internationally reached agreement to curb tobacco use?
The primary recommendation, and it's fairly straightforward, is that countries should reject the chamber's arguments. They should continue to move forward with the tobacco control measures that improve public health and save lives that they've been putting in place either through the WHO framework or through other measures that the country has implemented on their own. So that, I think, is sort of the core of the report, asking sovereign nations to not listen to a corporate interest like the U.S. chamber. Beyond that, we recommend that they kind of look further and think about the affiliate AmChams. And then finally, you know, one of the benchmark components that we uncover and is well known about the chamber is its secrecy as it relates to its political influence. So we want to make sure that we can uncover some of that, and we're calling on the chamber to disclose its political donors.
I've been talking with Lisa Gilbert. She is the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch. For more information, you can visit their website at citizen.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
Military contractor Kellogg Brown & Root has enraged Oregon's congressional delegation. KBR is asking for more than $850,000 in legal fees from Oregon Iraq War vets who accuse the company of causing their health problems. A federal lawsuit filed by more than 30 veterans against KBR identifies how exposure to sodium dichromate from a water treatment plant they were guarding in southeast Iraq in 2003 caused a number of health issues, including cancer. In a letter to Defense Secretary Ashton Carter, Senators Wyden and Merkley, along with Representatives Blumenauer, Schrader, Bonamici, and DeFazio, said, "We feel confident that Americans don't want their tax dollars supporting these scorched earth tactics, and because the Department of Defense, the DOD, may be responsible for KBR's legal bills, we urge you to exercise your authority, take over this litigation, and bring it to a fair conclusion for all parties." The signature of Representative Greg Walden, the delegation's only Republican member, was not on the letter. Andrew Malcolm, a spokesperson for Walden's office, said the congressman got the letter late and didn't have time to give it a proper review before signing. Malcolm said, however, that the office is doing its due diligence and may well send a very similar letter. A U.S. district court in Portland ruled in favor of the vets in 2012 and awarded each of them $85 million. But last May, the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals threw out that verdict for jurisdictional reasons. The Oregon delegation promises in its letter that the case will begin anew. Meanwhile, the Defense Department has urged all sides to come to an equitable settlement.
The U.S. House of Representatives is expected to vote this week on a bill that would block state efforts to label genetically modified foods, or GMOs. The bill, H.R. 1599, would prevent individual states from passing GMO labeling laws. States such as Vermont, which have already passed GMO labeling laws, could be prevented from implementing their regulations. The environmental protection group Food and Water Watch said that over 90% of Americans support the labeling of GMOs. But groups such as the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which represents large corporations such as Monsanto, Nestle, and Dow Chemical, have been lobbying in support of the House bill. If you'd like to voice your opinion on the bill to your representative, you can contact them by calling toll-free, I'll give you the number here, 866-772-3843, 866-772-3843.
After more than 50 years, the U.S. and Cuba have reopened their embassies today. While the reopening is monumental in the dialogue between the two nations, there are still several roadblocks to normalizing relations. FSRN's Nell Abram has more on Cuban relations, including the thorny issue of Guantanamo Bay and embargoes still in place against the island country.
Cuba's national anthem filled the air and hundreds of people cheered Monday morning as a color guard solemnly hoisted the country's flag in front of the Cuban embassy in Washington, D.C. Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez Padilla, presided over the ceremony.
Today, the reestablishment of diplomatic relations and the reopening of embassies complete the first stage of the bilateral dialogue and pave the way for the complex and certainly long process towards the normalization of bilateral relations. The challenge is huge, because there has never been normal relations between the United States of America and Cuba, in spite of 1.5 centuries of intensive and reaching links that have existed between both peoples.
Rodriguez Padilla was clear that while the ceremony officially restarts diplomatic relations, Cuba has very specific conditions that must be met before they will consider relations to be normal.
Only the lifting of the economic, commercial, and financial blockade, which has caused so much harm and suffering to our people, the return of the occupied territory of Guantanamo, and the respect for Cuba's sovereignty will lend some meaning to the historic event that we are witnessing today.
The Cuban flag was also raised at the State Department, where it now stands alongside the flags of other countries with which the U.S. has diplomatic ties. And in Havana, the U.S. interest section formally became a U.S. embassy. Later Monday, the Cuban foreign minister met with U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, and the two then held a joint press conference. Kerry reiterated the White House call for Congress to lift the embargo, but said clearly that the U.S. has no plans to vacate the naval base at Guantanamo Bay where the military continues to operate a detention camp that U.S. President Barack Obama pledged to close during his first week in office.
At this time, there is no discussion and no intention on our part at this moment to alter the existing lease treaty or other arrangements with respect to the naval station. But we understand that Cuba has strong feelings about it. And I can't tell you what the future will bring, but for the moment, that is not part of the discussion on our side.
The official restart of bilateral relations follows a series of recent diplomatic moves between the two countries. After months of secret negotiations, last December, President Obama eased some travel and financial restrictions when the two countries exchanged prisoners. U.S. government contractor Alan Gross and an unnamed spy for the last three of the Cuban five intelligence agents. Cuba also freed 50 political prisoners as part of the deal. Then in May, the U.S. removed Cuba from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. But there's still staunch opposition in Congress to lifting the embargo against Cuba and furthering the thaw between the two countries, particularly among the South Florida delegation. Representative Ileana Ross-Layton accuses the State Department of failing to take a stance against repression in Cuba, where she says the Castro regime continues to attack its people, and accuses President Obama of, quote, legacy shopping. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.
Three journalists for the UK tabloid The Sun have accused the London police of accessing their phone records in order to find sources for a story that brought down a senior minister. The journalists say their human rights were breached and have brought their case to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, or IPT. The IPT examines complaints about the unlawful use of covert techniques by public authorities. Detectives at the London Metropolitan Police used phone surveillance to discover who had leaked a police report to journalists at The Sun. After the London police found the sources of the leaked report, four officers were fired and one was sent to jail. A verdict is expected in the case later this year.
At least 30 people have been killed and another 76 injured in a bombing today in the Turkish town of Suric. It's still not clear who's responsible for the bombing, although Turkish officials are blaming a female suicide bomber with the Islamic State. The town of Suric is located across the border from the Syrian city of Kobani. Kurdish forces defeated Islamic State militants in Kobani last year. The bombing took place in the garden of a cultural center where members from the Federation of Socialist Youth Associations were gathered. The youth organization was planning a trip across the border to help rebuild Kobani. They plan to deliver toys, plant a memorial garden, and build a library and playground. The attack today is the most violent in Turkey since 2013, when at least 50 people were killed by two bombs planted by the Islamic State in another Turkish border town.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ryan Stroyer, Don Merrill, Kristen Yount, Ken Jones, and Rosalind Scott. The producer is Eric Takeoff. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jinka Soderbergh. Tonight's engineer is also Danielle Parks. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3386. 3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with, you guessed it, Abe and Joe. At 9, an alternative radio law professor Marjorie Cohn speaks on death from above drones. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host D. May Roberts presents two different pivotal times of Oregon World War II history. First, we'll find out about a new musical play called Vanport by Shalanda R. Then we'll hear about Never Give Up, an event that honors Portland native Minoru Yasui, who challenged the constitutionality of a curfew imposed on people of Japanese descent during the start of World War II in Portland. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, local artist Deb Stoner talks about her botanical portraits at Camerawork Gallery. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for your community radio station. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for News in Depth as we hear from KBOO's Ryan Stroyer. He joined local climate action groups as they spoke out against the actions of the Shell Oil Company on Saturday. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Climate activist groups gathered around the country on Saturday in protest of Shell.